Hello, podcast listeners. Fraser here. So here's another interview, not by me, but with me. And this was for the Worldviews podcast. And this is often a podcast that is covering more religious topics, but, religion really just didn't come up for the entire episode until the very end. And even so, it was, a really good conversation about, the usual stuff, aliens, multiverse, but my work as a space journalist and how I choose stories and think about my work and what question I would ask God if I could. The ending of the episode is quite abrupt, and that's just because he was interviewing me and his internet went down and I was just talking and then I realized that he was no longer there. And so I realized that I had to just kind of wrap up and say goodbye because that would be something that he would want to use for his version of the podcast. So, but still, I think you'll enjoy it. Fun conversation, and hopefully you'll learn a little bit more. All right. Enjoy the Worldviews podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Worldviews. Today we have on Fraser Kane. Fraser is a science journalist and amateur astronomist, as well as the founder of the popular space and astronomy news website, Universe Today. Fraser, thank you for joining us.
Devin, thanks for having me.
Of course. Fraser, can you just kick us off? What sparked your love for science and astronomy?
Well, science, I don't know. I mean, I feel like that's something that I've always just been super interested in, just curious about the world around me. For astronomy, I was really lucky. I had parents that were really into science fiction and astronomy. We would go and watch Star Trek movies as a kid, but also if there was a meteor shower happening, my parents would take me out to watch it. And so I grew up in an environment where I lived in the countryside, and so I sort of grew up an appreciation and a kind of an interaction with nature that had sort of carried me through my entire life.
Okay. How many meteor showers do you think you've seen?
Well, most of them come at times of the year when it's cold outside. And so after you've seen the best ones, the good summer ones, you tend not to watch them that often. I mean, there's about 20 meteor showers, major meteor showers that happen every year. But really there's one that I like, and that's the Perseids. That's the one that we get in August when it's nice outside. It's pretty good amount of meteors, and you sit outside and you watch them. The Leonids and the Geminids are better, but it's colder. The Geminids especially, it's December here in Canada. You don't want to go and stay out too long outside watching for meteor showers in Canada in December. So, but occasionally you get a meteor storm, and there was the Leonids back in 2001, I think it was. And I'm sure some of your audience remembers this, where there was a meteor a second falling, a meteor every couple of seconds. It was unbelievable.
Okay. So I read your career goes back to about sometime in the 90s. I know before that, at some point you started a company, then at some point got into Universe Today. So you've been doing this for years.
26 years.
What? 26 years to be exact. What in your career are you most proud of achieving?
I don't think I'm there yet. The job that I have is to take what I think are complicated technical subjects in research in space and astronomy, our understanding of the cosmos, the work that's being done in space exploration, and make that available and accessible to a general audience. And it's such a, I think, it's one of those things where you feel like it's taking you 26 years to be an overnight success. And so it's such a smooth curve all the way through that I can't sort of think of any moments. There's times when you're on a first name basis with Nobel Prize winners, or when you get a chance to talk with astronauts, or when you get a chance to talk to some of your heroes, and you can't believe that you're having these conversations. So, and so I think those are the times when I feel the best. But for me, the thing that makes me the proudest is to satisfy some of my curiosity, that I have a question. I have something that's kind of nagging at me. I don't know the answer to it. I find an expert. I'm able to ask the question. I'm able to get an answer. And the answer is really satisfying to me and fills in this piece of my missing knowledge. And every time that happens, it just feels great. And so I think if I was to think about what is my dopamine system triggered for, it's to have that curiosity satisfied. And then obviously that creates more questions and more things that I'm curious about.
Sure. Okay. Tell me about those heroes that you met. I guess, would it be like, when it comes to space, I'm just thinking, I'm a casual, obviously. Like Buzz Aldrin, guys like that?
So I haven't met Buzz Aldrin, but I've met half of the Apollo astronauts from the Apollo, you know, some of them have passed away. I've probably met 20 or 30 through interviews, like not necessarily in person, but
sure,
remotely. Probably 20 or 30 space shuttle, international space station astronauts. I've probably done 2,000 interviews at this point with astronomers and astrophysicists and engineers and people who work at space agencies and all of that. So yeah, I've just had a chance to talk to everybody.
Wow. Okay. That leads us to another question then. What do you think is the biggest or the biggest misconceptions about space? I imagine it involves black holes too, because I think people kind of confuse black holes. And there's also a rumor that space smells like bacon. I've heard that.
Apparently. I don't know. I've never been to space. What is the biggest misconception? I mean, it sort of just depends on where you come at, because I think there are misconceptions at sort of every level. Certain people have a very basic knowledge of things. And so like if you ever set up a telescope, there's a great way of connecting people with the hobby called sidewalk astronomy, where you just go and take a telescope and you set it up outside, you point it at the sky, point it at interesting objects that are up there right now. And people walk by and want to look through the telescope. And it's great. You know, you set it up outside of a concert or a hockey game, and you'll have lineups around the block of people waiting patiently to look through the telescope. And then they'll look and they'll see Saturn. And then they'll see the disk of the planet, and they'll see the rings. And if your telescope is good enough, they'll see the gap in the rings. They might see a couple of moons around Saturn at the time. And they'll be like, wait a minute. Is there a screen? How is this working? And you're like, no. There it is there. And you're like, point at the sky. And it's the light is coming from this thing, and it's going into the telescope. And then you're looking at it with your eye. And I would say like that first basic level for people is that they don't even connect with this cosmos that is all around us, that we live day after day after day. And yet there is this poetry of the cosmos moving all around you all the time. The sun is changing where it's rising and when it's rising, and the moon is showing up at different times of the month, and the planets are in different positions, and different constellations are visible in the sky at different times, and the Milky Way is only visible. And this is going on year after year after year. And until you start to pay attention to this stuff, people will just live their whole lives. They don't even realize, right? When's the next full moon? I don't know. Hey, weird. The moon looks so big tonight. You know, that's because it's a full moon and it happens once every 28 days. And here it is again. And so I think like that is the first step, is just this misconception that this stuff is connecting to you directly, and you're oblivious to it day in, day out. And then for the people who are into it, then there's all kinds of fine grade issues, you know, and, you know, from, as you say, black holes, telescopes, cosmos, all the way to really, you know, how Hawking radiation might work, or how dark matter, dark energy work. And so I think, you know, it sort of depends on how far along a person knows and doesn't know.
Okay. Can you, at a simple scale, explain what a black hole is and does?
Sure. Yeah. So like you're standing on planet Earth and it is pulling you down with its gravity, which is a simplistic version of what's actually happening. But anyway, and so if you want to get away from the Earth, you need to jump very fast. And that is your escape velocity. And I forget the exact escape velocity of Earth. It's fast, like 12 kilometers per second. You need to be able to jump off planet Earth at, you know, 35,000 kilometers per hour, some big number. And only if you are able to move that quickly will you fly off into space. Otherwise, you're going to jump up and then the gravity of Earth is going to pull you back down and you're going to crash onto planet Earth. So That is the escape velocity that's required to leave planet Earth. And so you can imagine a star, the sun, then the escape velocity is dramatically bigger because the gravity is stronger. And then there are various objects that are compact and have high gravity, like white dwarfs or neutron stars. And in those cases, you're starting to get where if you wanted to jump off of their surface, you'd be having to go a significant portion of the speed of light, like 20% the speed of light, to just jump off of one of these objects. And a black hole is just this place. It's where that escape velocity has exceeded the speed of light. The only way for you to be able to jump off the surface of a black hole is for you to go faster than the speed of light. And nothing can go faster than the speed of light in the universe. And so you are trapped within this thing. And even light, like light can go the speed of light, but that's not fast enough. And so the light has to stay in with the black hole as well. And so they are black. They are invisible because they are not emitting any light, because any emit that tries to get away is pulled back in. Any particles that try to get away are pulled back in. And so you can't see them because nothing can get away from them.
Ooh, okay, that's interesting. And I was thinking about this too as you're describing misconceptions and the astronaut stuff. I was thinking about those simultaneously. How mind-blowing it is that closeness in history between us flying in planes to going to space. Does that just blow your mind too?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, if you take this, there was this time at the beginning of the 20th century from the Wright brothers doing the first powered flight to 30 years later, people, you know, Indiana Jones flying in their airplane across continents to the early 60s human beings flying in space to the late 60s, early 70s people flying to the moon. For people who grew up in that time frame, it must have been mind-blowing how much all of that stuff accelerated. And then I think at the same time, though, there's the people of your generation, kind of my generation, where nobody went back, right? Like, I was born after the Apollo landings happened. My dad watched them, but I wasn't there for it. I was there for the space shuttle. I was there for other later missions. And of course, what's happening with reusable rocketry with SpaceX and things like that. But it feels, and I'm sure for a lot of your audience, it's going to feel like suddenly everything screeched to a halt and we didn't progress. Like, we got to the moon and then we didn't go back to the moon, which is really weird. And I think we see that in a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of our technology, you know, if you take a person from the 1900s, you know, 1905, and you bring them forward now, life will seem magical and baffling. But if you take a person from 1975 and you bring them to now, they'll get it pretty quick, right? Cars work the same, airplanes are kind of the same, computers are a bit better, but, you know, it's all kind of the same. So it is interesting how so many dramatic changes happened early on in the last century, and the rest of the stuff has felt much more like a fine tuning of it.
And within the field of science and astronomy, what topics have you changed your opinion or mind about?
Yeah, there's a bunch. I mean, I think it's always really important to just keep an open mind and to be ready to receive new evidence to then allow you to be, you know, to change your mind. Like, you want your beliefs to reflect the most accurate messages that nature is telling you and that the universe is telling you, right? And so you want to be able to change your mind and be very flexible about that. And so one that's big for me is that when I first started getting into this job, I was very much about human space exploration and that we were going to live on Mars. And there was a lot of really influential books at the time that I read that said, oh, you know, humans are going to build a city on Mars and it's going to be amazing. And then the more work that I've done being an actual journalist and reporting on the difficulties, the more I've turned away from that being a thing that I think is feasible or even preferable, that in fact, that Earth is so great that we have trees and we have oceans and we have animals and we have just all of this stuff that's provided to us just by default by living on this planet. If we go to Mars, we're going to have dust and mountains and rocks and radiation, and we're going to have to recreate as much of planet Earth as we can. And that no matter what we do, it will always be a pale shadow of planet Earth. And so I think science fiction tells us, oh, it's going to be this amazing, cool adventure. But actually, I think after a little while, it wouldn't take very long. You'd be like, oh, this sucks, right? There's dust everywhere. I really would like to just go for a swim in a lake, but I can't do that here because they just don't exist. And so I think my enthusiasm for human space exploration has significantly declined. Or I'm for exploration, but not colonization, not living on other worlds. I just think that Earth is the best place in the universe for us. And so anything that we try to do, we'll be trying to kind of recapture the magic of this planet that we happen to grow up on. The other thing, and this is, you know, a lot more controversial, is I personally, and this is my opinion, am fairly skeptical of the existence of aliens. I sort of believe that we are. Yeah, I know. It's my opinion that we're possibly the only intelligent civilization and maybe even the only life in the entire observable universe. And I'm happy to unpack that, but my argument takes a little while to get there.
Actually, we'll unpack that in a sec. I actually want to go back to what you said first about space exploration. Do you think, because everyone always asks, how close are we to that point? And no one really has a certain number. In your estimation, how close do you think we are to actually colonizing another planet? By that, I mean, I guess, the earliest stages of it, actually getting there and having people be able to live there for more than a year, say.
I would say we're about 100 years away. Yeah, I think if we want to have a research base on the moon or Mars, where we're going to be sending all of the resources that they require to live at a cost of hundreds of billions of dollars per person, then we could do that tomorrow, right? We could do that, I would say, or we could do that in 10 years. We could probably get to a place technologically where we could sustain a outpost on Mars with our current level of technology if the funding willingness was there, which it is absolutely not. But that is a different story from it being a self-sustaining place. A colony, right? And a place where you live. And so it's one thing to be, and I always sort of describe this as like being on the death zone, in the death zone on Everest, that once you cross a certain altitude on Everest, your body is breaking down. The only way you survive is by people bringing you goods to get you up to that point. And you have to come back down. You have to get out of that altitude. And Mars will probably be the same thing, that the only way that you can survive on Mars is with regular deliveries of all of the food and all of the water and all of the supplies that you require. Maybe you can make a little bit of it off the land in the way that people in Antarctica can pull in some snow, melt it with their fuel to make water to boil their tea. You know, you're living a little bit off the land, but you're not self-sustainable. You know, Antarctica is not a sustainable place. It only exists because the world's nations are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to keep that place going. And that's sort of my perspective. So we will eventually build the infrastructure and the technology to make a place like Mars self-sustaining and livable. I think it's just going to take a lot longer than people are hoping to hear. They want to hear that it's going to happen in 20 years. They want it to happen in their lifetime. They want to have the option and the choice to go to Mars and thrive there. And that is going to happen beyond our lifetime.
Yeah, because I guess the other point with that is there's not exactly a catalyst for us to actually go to Mars to fully.
Yeah, there's no reason to go. Like beyond it would be cool, is no financial reason, there's no economy that makes any kind of sense to go anywhere off planet Earth apart from launching satellites to orbit planet Earth. Every other possible financial reason that's ever been proposed falls flat and won't cover the costs. There could be bars of gold sitting on the surface of Mars, and it would be too expensive to go pick them up.
Yeah. And the alien take, I assume that's something your fans highly disagree with you with, or
you know, some have come around to my way of thinking at this point.
Okay,
you know, I can be very persuasive when I sort of unroll my full argument. But the short answer of the argument is, and this is like the heart of the, you know, I'm sure your audience has heard of the Fermi paradox. So you know, Enrico Fermi, this absolutely brilliant researcher back in the 1950s, was thinking about how the universe is big and the universe is old. And that the weird thing about life on Earth was that it appeared almost instantaneously. As soon as the Earth had cooled down to the point that life could form, it did. And then, you know, now we have all of the life forms that we have across this entire planet. And what Fermi said was, okay, so let's imagine this happened on other planets around the universe. And let's imagine that many of those civilizations are vastly more advanced than we are, that they would have had a 2 billion year head start than we did. Then where is everybody? That, you know, people should have developed, those other civilizations should have developed spacecraft that should have been able to allow them to move from star system to star system, self-replicating as they went. You send one to a star system, then you build two spacecraft, they go to two, they build four, you know. Things get exponential really quick. And he did this back of the envelope math and said, it should take about 10 million years for the entire Milky Way to be completely filled with life by some kind of exploring civilization. And, you know, a 10 million year chunk of time is nothing in the billions of years that the universe has existed before we showed up. And so if life is common, then on each one of those worlds, they could all take a crack at becoming these Milky Way spanning civilizations. And yet we don't see any evidence. When we look out into the cosmos, we see wilderness. It is as if nobody has ever been here, and that we are the first ones to even be able to contemplate leaving our star. So, you know, people who are listening to this are going to have a million, you know, like, we've only just started to look. And again, it's not about us looking, it's about them coming to us. And the analogy that I always use is a spider that, you know, if you ever go to the Hawaiian Islands, they have animals that are on Hawaii, and each one of those animals arrived through some really circuitous circumstance. Like the first spider arrived on Hawaii and another one didn't show up for 10,000 years later. But as soon as that first spider landed on Hawaii, you come back 1,000 years later and there are spiders on every single corner of Hawaii. And so it's not about you searching for spiders, it's about spiders searching for you. And so that's the same feeling that I have about the universe, is that it's not about us doing this exhaustive search for aliens. It's that in a universe that is very heavily populated, then it should just be obvious. In the same way that you get dropped into a forest or a city or anywhere on Earth, you go to anywhere on Earth and there's a few little places you could go where you look around and go, there's no life here. Otherwise, everywhere you go, it's going to look, there's life here. And so the expectation is that you would scale that up to the galactic version of that. And so because we don't see anything, then for me, it makes me feel that it's more likely that we're alone or we're the first.
Okay, that's a pretty good defense. But do most people in your field think there are aliens, or would you say it's totally, like 50-50?
No, I'd say, you know, I mean, I interview a lot of the people who do a lot of the work searching for aliens, and I would say they're more on the 50-50 camp, maybe even on the 70% think we're alone and 30% think there's aliens out there. But the less a person works on this, the more they shift to the 10% chance we're alone, 90% chance the universe is filled with aliens, or 1% chance we're alone and 99% chance the universe is filled with aliens.
Okay.
Because for us, it's a matter of faith. Right? It's like, how could it be any other way? It has to be true. Like, we're not special. The universe has to be filled with aliens. Where they're out there, we just haven't found them yet. And we're arrogant to think that we are the only civilization to be here.
Yeah, I think it was a matter of faith up until, it seems like the last 10 years has been some kind of shift towards this whole, because I assume you've been digging into the whole UFO hearings
oh,
since like, yeah. the past like 5 years. I think that's giving a lot more I want to use the word credibility, but a lot more, I'll use credibility for the sake of it, towards people that believe in UFOs because of this whole possibility of it being a government cover-up mixture with all the series of UFO sightings that people tend to have, even though you can seriously throw away 99% of them for being some kind of natural phenomenon, people are lying, or some kind of explainable technology that maybe the government actually has. But there is that 1% that is very much...
Hasn't been explained.
That's the thing people hold on. Mixture of that, plus again, the government hearings.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I hope is that the people who've gone through this and they got very excited about the UAP hearings, how come nothing came of it, right? You had Senate hearings, you had new laws drafted that demanded that any hidden information be revealed. You had a investigation from the Pentagon and a separate investigation from NASA. You had various projects actually being funded to do comprehensive searches for UFOs, UAPs, and nothing came of it. So, you know, and that is not a surprise to me. Like, I was not expecting the people who have been proposing that this is real have been saying this since the 90s, and they've never been able to deliver any evidence of what they say. They've just been able to make the case more eloquently and get more and more people to follow along with them, and yet they still have yet to deliver any, like, one tiny little scrap of evidence that anybody would go, yeah, I don't have an explanation for this.
I guess it sounds like you're pretty open-minded to it, though, to the degree where if they did announce it, that aliens were real and actually showed evidence, you'd be like, oh, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If the aliens showed up, or if someone said, hey, look, we found this material that is, there's just no way it could be done. It had to be done by aliens, or here's a signal that we're receiving in our radio telescopes, or here is a measurement of a chemical in the atmosphere of an exoplanet. Like we are now at this place where we do have the tools to answer this question. And this is the thing that's new. Only in the last, say, 10 years have we built the James Webb Space Telescope. Have we built a rover that's capable of exploring on Mars? Have we got these capabilities to practically search for civilizations and even any kind of life out there in the cosmos? And it's switching from a kind of a belief and a faith to something that we can test. And I think that over time, as we continue to search and test, it'll break one way or the other. We will either get an answer like, yeah, we're not alone in the universe. We are just one tiny corner of a huge, vastly populated universe with all of its interactions. And that's scary, right? That we're suddenly being invited to a party that we had no idea about. But the other possibility is that we are alone, that no matter where we go, this entire cosmos, it's just going to be rocks and stars and ice as far as we can go. And it shows the level of kind of responsibility that we have to take for our planet and the future of even like life in the universe. It's kind of onto us. That's maybe scarier, I think.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah. And this is the classic quote by Arthur C. Clarke, right? Mm-hmm. Responsibilities exist. Either we're alone or we're not. And both are equally terrifying.
Yeah, I think if I was to guess, I would probably say, honestly, being surrounded would be pretty terrifying.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be more terrifying, I think.
Probably, yeah. But more interesting more of a, too, right? Like that's the problem. I'm sure what you're talking about is like, man, it would be scary, but they'd be cool to meet if they didn't want to eat me. Then they'd be cool, right? Like that's always the challenge, which is that when we are placed in unfamiliar circumstances, it brings danger, but also brings opportunity. And we as human beings, we react to both with excitement and nervousness.
Yeah, because the challenge is too, we have no idea, because the only thing we have really is how aliens are displayed in pop culture. So the range is almost right. From aliens of War of the Worlds to aliens from the childhood's end book, or aliens from the movie Arrival, or aliens from Project Hail Mary, another science fiction book. There's such a wide range of things. Whether
or Shrek,
that's just,
or Babylon 5, like it just goes on. Yeah.
Yeah, it's even outside of whether or not they're aggressive. It's also whether or not we could even come close to understanding anything of them, and then to us too. But yeah, it's so interesting. And then we talked about the James Hubble telescope. What do you believe are the greatest discoveries within astronomy in the last 20 years? One to three discoveries, or maybe five if you have more.
Yeah. Huh. That's always such a really difficult question for me to answer, because for me, it is such a smooth continuity of discoveries that are being made. And so I can think about specific things like in 2015, we saw the first gravitational waves coming from colliding black holes. And this was something that was always theorized would happen. And they had for decades been trying to build the instruments that could actually make these detections. And they finally pulled it off. They finally detected this first collision between two black holes, hundreds of millions of light years away. And since then, they've made two more upgrades to this equipment, and they're now detecting black hole mergers every couple of days. So what was incredible about that is that we now had a brand new way to see the universe. Like, everything that we see in the universe currently is with photons. Radio waves are photons, X-rays are photons. Visible light, it's all photons. Infrared, you feel heat with your hand, that's photons. You get a sunburn from the sun, that's photons. It's all photons. They're just different wavelengths. And so it's all the same thing. But with gravitational waves, you had a completely new way to look at a thing. It's the age of, it's called multi-messenger astronomy. And so suddenly look at colliding black holes, both in the ripples of gravitational waves that emanated from this collision and from the radiation that comes from the collision between enormous objects. And that's brand new. I mean, that is only within the last 10 years that we've been able to do this. There are a lot of really interesting discoveries that are still kind of unfolding. You know, 25 years ago, a little over 25 years ago, we discovered that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. It was thought that it was slowing down, but actually it's accelerating, which is weird. And it's going to sort of keep on, you know, it's imagine you threw a ball up in the air and you're expecting it to fall back down into your hand. And instead it just speeds off into space. That's weird. Nobody ever did it. And yet that appears to be the way the universe works. And then from a physics side, there's a confirmation of the Higgs boson, the Higgs field, that, that matter, there's a field that regulates mass. And this was confirmed in the Large Hadron Collider for the first time. We discovered, there's so many. I don't even know where to start. It's funny because they're all little versions. They're details. In 2019, astronomers used a worldwide group of satellites, of radio telescopes to take a picture of a black hole, to take a picture of the event horizon or shadow of an event horizon around a black hole. Mind-boggling picture when you look at it and know what it is that you're looking at. That they had to build a telescope as big as planet Earth to be able to do this. In 1995, we saw the first planet orbiting around another sun-like star. We now know of probably 6,000 or 7,000 of these things in every different configuration. I mean, now I don't even, if I see that new planets have been discovered, I'm like, meh, well, like what's special about this planet that otherwise I won't even report on it. Like, 10 more planets, I don't have time for this. So it's amazing how we have just internalized this. We've discovered that Enceladus, which is one of the moons of Saturn, has a liquid ocean under the surface and it is spraying material, this ice water, out into space that contains the chemicals of life. And so in theory, there could be life under the ice on Enceladus, and it would be relatively easy for us to go and find it and confirm it. We saw the first close-up pictures of Pluto taken by NASA's New Horizons spacecraft, which was incredible. It just goes on and on and on. I could do this, I could literally just do this all day. And if I had a reference in front of me, then I could do this all week.
Yeah. So I guess too, on top of that, what kind of discoveries are on the horizon that we see that are coming up possibly that we're looking
at? Yeah. Well, I mean, there's some incredible new tools that are just being developed now. Some of which I'm sure people are familiar with, like the James Webb Space Telescope, is this telescope capable of just incredible observations. It looks right out to the very edge of the observable universe and sees the first galaxies coming together, the building blocks of the kinds of galaxies that we have. And this is a huge gap in our understanding, our knowledge, you know, that how did a big spiral galaxy like the Milky Way come together over the age of the universe? You have to watch this process come together. And what's great is the telescopes are time machines. They can look back and see the farther away they look, the more they're looking back in time. So they just have to look in the right place to see these early galaxies coming together at different stages of that evolution to what turned into a galaxy like the Milky Way. And James Webb is doing this. It is seeing these galaxies and answering really important questions. So, you know, and we're only 3 years into life with James Webb. There's another probably 17 years ahead where it will continue to send us data. And then the other thing is that there are a bunch of telescopes that have all come online to answer these really fundamental questions about the large scale structure of the universe, the cosmology, the dark matter, the dark energy. What is it? And so there are five different telescopes and space missions that have all come online within the last year or so to be able to make these kinds of observations. And so we may not know what dark matter and dark energy are, but we will at least have them observed down to the best measurement possible. So we know exactly, you know, I always sort of describe it, you know, if there's a funny sound coming from your car and you don't know what it is, and you show the mechanic says, yeah, I can hear that sound too. Okay, like, you know, there's something wrong with your car and you don't know what the problem is yet. And so now astronomers are trying to figure out what is the sound coming from the car. And they will they'll know exactly how often the clunk happens and exactly the wavelength of the ting, ting, ting that's coming off of the engine. And they will have been able to rule out a whole bunch of things. It's not a rock in the wheel. It's not a problem on the drive shaft. It's probably in the engine. It's probably in the third cylinder, right? Like, that's where they're getting to. And that's all, you know, that's going to be, you know, like I said, so many telescopes are going to be pulling together to be able to do this. And then the one that I'm most excited about right now is called the Vera Rubin Observatory. And this is a telescope that is being built in Chile right now. It's done, it's complete. They've installed the camera. It's the biggest camera that's ever been built on Earth. It's a 4.3 gigapixel camera. So think about your phone, however many megapixels it has. You know, that's adorable. And we'll take an image at an incredible depth of the entire night sky from the Southern Hemisphere every about three nights. And what's important is that up until now with astronomers, they take their pictures of the entire sky maybe once every 10 years. And that anything new that happened, supernova going off, asteroids moving through the sky, weird things going bump in the night, UAPs, right? These are all things that are happening over time. And now this new telescope is going to catch the things that the universe was doing when we weren't looking. All of the, it's called time domain astronomy. And now suddenly you'll see all of the pops of all of the supernovae that are going off in the cosmos around us, all the asteroids drifting through the field of view in all the directions they're going. This is the telescope that will find Planet Nine. And we are just a couple of months away from it seeing first light. And I think is going to totally change our understanding of the cosmos.
That is amazing. You have a pretty sweet job. You know that?
I do. I'm aware. Yeah. You're kidding. 26 years. I'm not stopping.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so interesting. Also, random question. Your first name, are you named after a relative? I just never met someone named Frazier before. I've obviously heard the name before, but I've actually first time meeting someone named Frazier.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so it's a more common, it's a Scottish name, and I'm named after my grandfather, and he, I think, was named after there's a river here in Canada called the Fraser River, and he was named after the river, I think. But it's a very common name in the UK, and that's my heritage.
Okay.
My heritage. Yeah.
Cool. Sorry, intrusive thoughts. But also, yeah. I want to ask, because you've interviewed so many people, so many brains, so many highly intelligent, the world's, you know, most intelligent people that we have to offer. Who would you say are the, I don't know, top three, top five smartest people you've ever talked to?
Oh.
That just scared you with their intellect.
Man, so I have a really lame answer for you, which is that generally almost all of the people that I get a chance to interview are have this kind of scary intellect that, like, have you ever played, do you play chess?
I play chess, yeah.
Okay, so you ever played a game of chess against somebody who's so much better than you, and they're beating you, and you don't know how, you don't know why, but it's this kind of, just this inexorable feeling that you are being crushed on the chessboard, right? And it, and so it's really hard to kind of put a, like, oh, here's the thing that this person is much, but no, it's just this feeling that you get. And so you will talk to this person who is incredibly intelligent. Like I said, I've interviewed people with Nobel Prizes. I've interviewed people who are designing some of these incredible telescopes, and they make connections and they understand things. And you ask them a question, and they're like, this question that just occurred to you, they've been thinking about this for a decade, you know, and have explored it to every single nook and cranny of where it ever goes. And for me, I'm always just so grateful that I can walk out the other side of the interview and them not feel like I wasted their time, right? Like, when they give me that's a really good question, or, oh, I hadn't thought of that, or, you know, then you're like, oh, yes, right? I'm helping, right? But I would say the people who are the most impressive are the astronauts, because they're amazing. And I don't know if you've ever had a chance to talk to an astronaut, but you're like, oh, I get it. I get why you were chosen as an astronaut, because they have multiple degrees. They are test pilots. They are in incredible health. They are, you know, very well thought, you know, very well sort of organized people who, and are just so nice, because they have to work in close proximity with other people. And if you're not a good person, then you get thrown out immediately. No one has time for a jerk when you're trapped in a space station. And so they are the whole package. And it's astonishing to sit with one of these astronauts and chat with them. And you're just like, I can do this all day. Like, I can just, you know, kind of be a friend, because they're so great. And you can see how that selection process, I mean, what the US does for selecting its astronauts, they really are the best of the best. And it's such a pleasure to chat with people like that. So they're the ones who I'm always, you know, with scientists, at this point, I'm kind of numb. I'm like, yeah, you know, we're going to talk about science. But when I get a chance to talk to an astronaut, I still feel the kind of the butterflies in my stomach. And I'm like, you know, swooning a little when I talk to them.
Yeah, because on top of their intellect, they have to be dangerously motivated, curious, fearless too.
Yeah. But not fearless, but, like, you know, appropriately fearless. Like, they are cautious, but fearless. They are nice, but not pushovers. They are intelligent, but not jerks about it. They are well-read, but they're not going to put it in your face. They are humble, right? They're just every part of a human being that you most aspire to, when you get a chance to interact with them.
Okay, that's awesome. And how do you think our sort of understanding of our place in the cosmos affects our sense of purpose and meaning?
Well, I think this is a thing where, you know, back to that thing where I talked about where people are disconnected from it. Like, the cosmos is everything. The cosmos is this giant region that is billions of light years across. And we are one planet in this enormous cosmos, that there are so many secrets out there. There's so much to know. And that it's what you get when you do look out into the cosmos and you consider these things. You look at this nebula and it is forming stars that are forming new planets. And it is tens of light years across. There could be 1,000 stars in that thing. And each one of those is kind of like the sun. And each one of those is going to have planets. Like, it's hard not to feel connected to the cosmos. And then when you think about what Carl Sagan, you know, we are made of stardust. And we literally, the atoms in our bodies were made in stars. Stars crashing into each other, stars exploding. This is what created the heavier elements that we need to be able to be. We are all the result of stars that have gone through many generations, which is just sort of like you're connected physically to the history of the cosmos.
Mm. And the, uh, because you mentioned fine tuning earlier, and the fine tuning of the universe is a topic that some point to as an evidence for design from a creator. Where would you sort of stand on this argument? Like, what's your perspective on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you hear that as an example of like, you know, the universe is like fine tuned for life. And obviously there's kind of like two ways you can approach it. One is that you couldn't even exist if you didn't live in a universe that had the ability to support life. You know, there could be a quadrillion universes, each of which all of the various characteristics of the universe were somehow different, and gravity didn't work in the right way, or nuclear bonds didn't work, and just life wasn't possible. And so there couldn't be life forms to go, isn't it weird that this universe seems to allow us to live in this universe, right? But when you look at the universe that we do live in, it sort of feels like it's the minimum viable universe. Like, any worse, and this, you know, if the universe was any worse, then life wouldn't be possible. And so the vast majority of this entire cosmos, the huge volume of space that's out there, is not habitable. The most common objects in the universe, the stars and stuff, are not habitable. The most of the planets that are out there, and the moons and the Kuiper belt objects and the asteroids that are out there, they're not habitable. Earth itself, when you sort of really look at planet Earth, most of it is not habitable. That you've got a region, just this band from a couple of kilometers above the surface of the Earth to a couple of kilometers below the surface of the Earth that are habitable. And then below that, you have thousands of kilometers of superheated rock that is not habitable. And I can imagine versions of the universe that are more habitable, but that's not the one that we live in. We live in the one that, if it was any worse, then we wouldn't be here at all. But it could be better. I can imagine versions that are more habitable. And so when I think about how fine-tuned it is, it's like someone really, if it is fine-tuned, they really phoned it in.
Mm. And speaking of universes, do you subscribe to the multiverse theory?
I'm a journalist, not a scientist. And so, you know, generally I just report. And so some people believe in the multiverse theory, others don't. The multiverse theory provides an elegant explanation for the weird things, the quantum mechanics, you know, the weird quantum effects that happen. But the Copenhagen interpretation also answers those same issues. There are versions of multiverses that actually are guaranteed to exist in this universe. You know, I don't know how far deep this rabbit hole you want to go, but if the universe is infinite in time, then anything that can happen will eventually happen, right? Mm. Because you've got an infinite amount of time for you know, if you're going to roll the dice over and over and over again, eventually you're going to get however many ones that you need to get the answer you were looking for. But also, if the universe is infinite space, then if there's a finite configuration that matter can be arranged in, then eventually, if you go far enough, you're going to get a repeat, and eventually you're getting an infinite repeat. And then, you know, there's going to be an infinite number of people having this exact conversation on planets that look exactly like Earth across an infinite universe. Which then, you know, there goes my whole "we're alone in the universe." So if we live in an infinite universe, and if the future of the universe is infinite in time, then you just kind of get multiverses by default.
Yeah, because I guess if there is a multiverse, we still can be alone in this universe.
Yeah.
But the other universes could have life everywhere, but they're just another universe. It's so confusing, though, because because a multiverse would suggest we're jumping dimensions. And I don't even know exactly what a dimension even means.
No, I mean, you're not even jumping dimensions. But okay, so like, imagine a cubic meter of space, like just a cubic meter. And so in that cubic meter, there are 10 to the power of 80, so a 1 followed by 80 zeros, of possible configurations in that cubic meter. So you could have, you know, an electron here and a neutron there, and an electron there and a neutron here, and a proton over there, and then the muon over here and the neutrino over there. And that if you sort of do the math for all of that space, you end up with 10 to the power of 80, which is an enormous number. It's a, you know, it's a gargantuan number. And yet it is a finite number. And so if you then go out into space to a very far distance, you're going to see different versions of that cubic meter space. It's going to try and work through all 10 to the power of 80 combinations. But eventually, you're going to get a repeat. Like, imagine you're playing Minecraft, right? And you've got like a 10 by 10 square of Minecraft blocks. And then you go far away, and eventually you're going to see another 10 by 10 square of Minecraft blocks that are exactly the same as the one that you got. And eventually, every chunk of Minecraft blocks has to be a repeat of another one, because the maximum number of Minecraft blocks is the type of blocks. You know, if there's 100 different kinds of blocks and they are in a configuration, then there has to be repeats if you go an infinite distance. And so same thing goes with the universe, that eventually you're going to reach a repeat of a chunk of universe that it will have, because there's only a finite number of configurations. You keep going and you'll get more of them. And eventually everything will be a repeat. And so everything that is possible will repeat an infinite number of times in an infinite universe.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense then.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Cool. And so you get a multiverse just with our regular universe. You don't need to have dimensions or any of that stuff. You just end up with another universe. And you get up with an infinite number of us's having this conversation just within this universe. You don't even need to have another universe.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense then. All right.
And then you can do the same thing if you just think about with time. That if you're willing to go forward in time, and that if quantum mechanics allows things to rearrange themselves in random ways from time to time, then you will eventually have the universe rearranging it into this configuration. You, me, talking on a podcast.
Cool.
An infinite number of times. Yeah. Yeah. I know.
That's so interesting. It's just, yeah.
There's so many of these. I mean, like, once you start to really consider the implications of some of the cool stuff that people are figuring out, you could just, you know, just ponder it all day.
And what would you say for you is also your, because I take it you're a science fiction movie guy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What's your Mount Rushmore of science fiction films?
So science fiction films. It's funny because I haven't really settled on my sci-fi films, but I've settled on my TV shows.
Okay, let's do that.
Yeah, yeah. So, and there are five in no particular order. And I think there's like a couple of honorable mentions. So, this is fresh in mind, but Andor, which we just finished watching this week, is, I think, the best thing that Star Wars has ever done. Better than Star Wars. It's such a good show. The Expanse, which is just an incredible show about the future of human space exploration in the solar system. This show called For All Mankind, which is about like, what if the Soviets were the first ones to land on the moon? And then you sort of get this alternate future where the US and the Soviets are racing to colonize the solar system, but it's very accurately done. This show called Love, Death, and Robots, it's on Netflix, and they just did another episode, but they are they're taking classic science fiction short stories, the kinds of stuff you'd read in pulp magazines and stuff, and making cool little animated movies about them. And they're just so good. And then I think Star Trek Deep Space Nine is probably my favorite of the Star Trek series. The one that felt the most complicated and did a great job of sort of world building and stuff like that. And then I have a bunch of honorable mentions with Babylon 5. And, you know, I'm sure people are going to go, what about? Stuff too. Yeah. We watch a ton. Like, I've seen it all. And this is the stuff that I love the most.
Okay. And what are there any movies that come to mind too on top of that?
I loved The Martian. Like, I just loved it. And I can't wait to see the Project Hail Mary movie that's coming out. Oof.
Did you read the book?
Yeah. I'm stoked. I'm so ready. I've interviewed Andy Weir a couple of times, and he's a riot. So much fun. It's tough. TV shows stick with me better than movies. I mean, I have all these classics that changed me as a, you know, Star Wars, when I first watched it, blew my mind as a 7-year-old.
Did you see it in theaters?
Yeah.
Whoa, that must have been mind-blowing.
It was, absolutely. Man. Like, nothing compared at that point, right? Aliens. There's tons of great science fiction.
Do you have a Mount Rushmore for science fiction books?
I would say, like, I'm a big fan of Isaac Asimov, and the original Foundation books were some of my favorites. Like, reading those really were great. But I'd say more recently, I've really fallen in love with the Culture series by Ian M. Banks, which is sort of this idea of, like, what would a possible hopeful future look like for a Milky Way spanning civilization that has artificial intelligence ships who exist peacefully with each other, and everyone lives in this kind of post-scarcity society. What kinds of problems would a civilization like that have? And they do have problems. And so it's kind of really interesting where it's like, if a civilization has almost magical power, can do anything, what challenges do they face? And I would say the sort of the greatest of that is the second book in the series called The Player of Games, where the main character is a game player. That he's the best in the universe, in the known universe, at playing games, in designing games and playing them. And he's been invited to a planet where they do a game that sort of defines, is their form of democracy. And they want him to play their game for their own political reasons. And he comes and plays the game and does really well and learns of all this political intrigue. And you'd sort of get these great senses of what the society is like. The Culture series is just epic. And, you know, again, it was listening to this. You've read the Culture series. You know what I'm talking about. And then the other one that gives that very similar flavor is the Revelation Space series by Alistair Reynolds. Very much about... do you ever play the Mass Effect video games?
You know, I've heard those are sensational.
They are good.
But I never got into them.
Yeah, I think they're the best, you know, they're the Mount Rushmore of science fiction games. And Revelation Space really kind of hits those same things. This really complicated. He's a physicist by training, so he's got this really great kind of scientific foundation for everything he talks about. And yet it's this far future, advanced civilization, humans, where they are uncovering this ancient evil, this primordial evil in the cosmos, and are sort of trying to defend civilization against it. And it's so good. Yeah. Alistair Reynolds is just an astonishingly good writer.
Wow. Yeah, sometimes it seems like, because obviously you've talked to very brilliant minds, but just getting to dive in these books and understanding how creative the human mind can really be to create its own world,
yeah,
completely foreign to ours,
yeah,
but just develop it through the brain of one person to create all of that.
Yeah,
like, people are impressed by, like, the Harry Potter series and stuff like that kind of world building, but doing it on, like, a planetary scale, on a universal scale, with its own set of rules, different personalities.
Even Harry Potter. I mean, you know, just the level of creativity and world building that went into that.
Sure.
Just, you know, having this society thought out in this way is very clever. And I think that kind of stuff, when it feels well done, when it feels like someone took the care to think through the implications in the ways that that really kind of grow with you. Like, another one of the TV shows, it's one of my favorites, is the Stargate SG-1 series. And they did such a great job of, as humanity was using the Stargate network and finding the Goa'ulds and the aliens and learning more about them, they were building up their technology. And if you go, you know, by the end of the series, human beings, you know, we have starships capable of jumping from planet to planet. We have alien Earth hybrid fighters able to, you know, dogfight with alien spacecraft in the atmosphere, that there's this kind of continuity and growth and a realistic expectation that if we did come across all this technology, we would incorporate it, we would get in, we would improve. And they take that all very seriously. And it shows, it really feels that someone is thinking about this stuff. And that's what I love especially when something happens and you're like, oh, come on, this wouldn't work this way. And then they show, oh, no, they knew what you were thinking was going to happen, and then what you expected, and they've turned it on you, and you just feel like, oh, fair play, you got me.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Such a good feeling. That's my best feeling, where I'm sort of hoisted on my own petard, right?
Yeah. Wait, do you have any books? I feel like you'd be a really good fictional writer.
I used to write role-playing games. So I've done source books for Shadowrun and Earth Dawn and GURPS back in the day. But no, I just consume media these days.
Okay, cool, cool. And have you ever experienced something paranormal or supernatural? You ever see a UFO?
No, no, no. It's funny, right? Like astronomers don't see UFOs. Right?
I guess that adds to the aliens aren't real theory.
Possibly, you know, like someone will be like, whoa, what's this? And you check your Skywatch app, like, oh, that's a Starlink satellite, right? Right? We're like, you know, like, oh, I saw this light glowing over on the horizon last night. You mean Venus?
Yeah.
Venus. Here, let's look through a telescope. There you go. Look at Venus. So no, I've never experienced anything supernatural in my life.
Okay. And so what's next for you? Like, what's coming down the pipeline in your world?
Well, at this point, I have no grand goals. We had a really sort of significant transition in the organization a couple of months ago. You know, many of the people who are creating media have found their audiences, or that it's being harder and harder to create media for this new landscape that you've got the AI algorithms that are generating enormous amounts of slop content that's just polluting the internet. You've got companies like Facebook and X and all of this that are trying to keep you in their walled gardens. Advertising networks are decreasing paying out people. And we were able to make this transition to be only covered by Patreon. And so now we are 100% funded just by the fans, and all of our content is completely free. There's no ads on our website. There's no cookies, no trackers, nothing. And everything we release is now Creative Commons 4.0. So anyone can use our stuff, make their own videos, make their own podcasts, you know, release our text in their astronomy newsletter, whatever. And it's all funded by the fans. And so and it's been, you know, of the 26 years, 24 of my years have been spent worrying about the funding, about growth, about what if Google gets mad at me, all of that. And now all of that concern has just completely evaporated. And so that's, for right now, we're kind of just digesting because we made this cut about 2 months ago. And now, in fact, when you reached out to me, you're like, hey, you want to do this podcast? I'm like, I would, but I don't have 1 second of time. And it's been 2 months to kind of get out the other side of this. And now it's smooth sailing. Like, now I just get up every day and say, what am I curious about? What do I think my audience wants to learn about? And then we report, we seek knowledge and have a good time.
Awesome. That's cool too, to the zealousness of your fans.
Totally.
That's really awesome.
Yeah. And I think for the people who are listening to this, that there's stuff that you love, and what would happen if that went away? You know, probably, you know, I don't know about your business model, Devin, but everybody is struggling. Everybody is, you know, it's probably a labor of love that, you know, the thing that makes you show up every day to do this work is because there's a message that you want to contribute, that there's a voice that you have to give, but it requires your energy and your effort. And to create a level of quality that people kind of expect, it takes more and more from you. And eventually you get to this point where you're like, I can't do it anymore. I can't give. I can't make these sacrifices to my friends, my family, my health. When I could just go get a job, right? Like, just get a job and pay my way and not have to think about any of this ever again. And that if there's stuff that people are all listening to right now, I guarantee you that most of the things that you love, the person is struggling to be able to create that thing. And that the way you make sure that the thing you love stays around is that you support it directly with your funds. So for me, you know, when cable went away, I just started funding the stuff that I love directly. And as my tastes change, as my, you know, things fall in and out of my favor, then I rearrange my, you know, I rebalance my portfolio of direct support. But I spend about $100 a month personally to support each of the people who I think are, you know, I allocate it based on how much of my time I spend. And that sort of make sure that I know that I'm contributing to the health of the content that I'm consuming.
One last question for you. We ask everyone on the show that comes on one question you can ask God if you knew for a fact he'd answer you right here and right now, what question would you ask?
I would probably ask the problem of evil. I would ask why bad things happen to good people.
I don't know if you might be the first one actually to ask that question directly, surprisingly. It's a pretty common one, like amongst the masses. But I think you might be the first one on the show to actually ask that. It's between that and I guess kind of a spinoff of it is, where have you been? Divine hiddenness to a degree, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I get that one as well. If you were here all along, why did you make it so hard to find you? Right. But I feel that sort of like nestles inside of the, it's part of like this, because a person can have a crisis of faith. A person can be going through a very difficult time, and it would, it's when you're going through a difficult time and you call your friend and your friend is on the other end of the line and they're talking you through it and they're there to support you, then you now have the support that you need. And I think that if a person's going through a really hard time and they put out the call and they don't hear the response, that is sort of part of the, now a bad thing is happening to a good person. So I feel like my question enfolds that other one inside of it as well, which is just, we see so much suffering in the world, to children, to animals, to so much. And you'd be like, why is this happening? That would be my question. Now, as an atheist, I have an easy answer. Thanks, right. Devin. It was a lot of fun chatting with you. And of course, if people want to find out more about what I do, just check out the website, universetoday.com. We've got a podcast. We've got a weekly email newsletter that I write. And of course, we do a lot of videos over on YouTube. So you just search for my name or Universe Today across all the things. All right. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Free audio post-production by Alphonic.com.